You know, how could you not be depressed if you're realistic, right? Like, you look at the economy. If someone's upbeat about that, you gotta wonder, are they lost touch with reality? So, I think that sometimes, like, we're talking about writers, I mean, they kind of sit at their desk all day and think about really depressing things, and at some point, it kind of takes them over or something.
Well, it's almost like a result of intelligence if you're willing to follow that wide rabbit
the way he runs the email.
You can go in a really dark path just connecting the dots.
Well, reality is pretty grim in many cases. I mean, it's...
Nah, man. I mean, like... You're just walking down the street and you get hit by a bus. No big deal. Like, that's reality. Like,
if you lived.
No,
is it no big deal if you live?
But one thing,
is it hurt?
Human behavior can be very disappointing, and after you'll appreciate this as you get older, but I mean, it's just after you see people kind of repeatedly disappoint, it's hard, and writers kind of deal with this kind of thing. You know, they think about these kind of things, it's hard not to get depressed. You look at all that goes on in the world every day, and especially now, you guys are growing up in a time with a lot of terrorism and things. And you watch this stuff going on for hundreds of thousands of years. So the engineers, you retreat to your desk and you go build a little piece of electronics. Let's talk about Z-Transform and its ROC property. So we're now going to shift to our last major transform, the Z-Transform. And the point in today's lecture, we're going to spend a little bit of time on ROC curves and that, but probably the two most important things today are the definition of the Z-Transform and how the J omega axis gets mapped into the Z-domain, into the, what we call the Z-axis, because that's going to be very important in understanding how discrete time systems behave. So hopefully, keep those two thoughts in mind as we wade through some of the details of ROC curves and that. So let's first begin with the definition of the Z-transform. The Z-transform, the good news is it's based on the Laplace transform, so it's going to look very similar in many ways to a Laplace transform. The bad news is it's in discrete time, and therefore, it's not really bad news, but it's going to involve sums instead of integrals and things like that, which is not bad, but it's just a little bit, initially it'll seem a little bit uncomfortable. So the Z-transform is a special case of the Laplace transform, and it results from applying the Laplace transform to a discrete time signal. So we take the definition of the Laplace transform. This x of s is equal to the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of x of t e to the minus s t dt. And we set time, we make time discrete. So t becomes n times delta t, where delta t is related to our sample frequency. And we can rewrite this as the limit as delta t goes to zero of the sum from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity of x of n times delta t times delta t. This is essentially our expression for x of n, replacing the x of t. And then we have e to the s times delta t from here. And then we have this sort of the derivative, the integral basically gets replaced by the sum. So this gives us, in the limit, that x of z is equal to the sum from n is equal to minus infinity to plus infinity of x of n, z to the minus n. And this is actually fairly easy to compute, especially if x of n is time limited, because this is just the sum of terms where we have z to the minus n. But this process has some implications, particularly in terms of the way the frequency axis is mapped. So let's consider how this transformation maps the S-plane into the Z-plane. So in the S-plane, we have S is equal to J omega, and we can write that Z is equal to E to the S times delta T which means we can substitute for J omega, for S we can substitute for J omega, we can write J omega delta T. Now, the S equals J omega in the S plane, of course, corresponds to the J omega axis. So, this E to the J omega delta T, well, the first thing we can notice is that the magnitude of this is equal to 1. So, the J omega axis in the S plane maps to the magnitude of Z is equal to 1 in the Z plane, which if you think about the points that satisfy this equation, this is just a circle of radius 1. So the J omega axis maps to the unit circle in the Z plane. And that's important, because that's going to define the behavior of discrete time systems. But note also, when we have, remember the sample theorem, and remember the sampling theorem said that when I take a real continuous time signal and I sample it, and then I compute the frequency response to that signal, what do we know, what did we observe about the periodicity of the frequency response? It's what? The response of the discrete time signal and the frequency response was a periodic function, right? It repeated every f sub 2 pi or in the radian in omega, or f sub s in the absolute frequency. So when I travel up the J omega axis for a discrete time signal, every time I go a distance 2 pi, I'm going to see the spectrum essentially repeat itself. So what happens with this mapping from the J omega axis to the Z axis is every time I make a full cycle around the circle, I essentially go from a frequency of 0 to a frequency of f sub s. The J omega axis here gets folded around here, but since this is infinite and it's periodic, essentially every period gets mapped as one cycle around the J omega axis. So if you were to walk along this axis, you're going to actually repeat many times, make, you know, complete revolutions around the circle. So this point becomes a frequency of 0. This point becomes a frequency of fs over 2. And then when I come back here, this becomes a frequency of f sub s. And we'll see more of that later as we probe more deeply into this. So, but for the moment, let's just observe that the J omega axis gets mapped to the unit circle. Now, if I look at the equation, S is equal to sigma plus J omega, and I treat sigma as a constant, what is the difference between these two equations in terms of the points that satisfy these equations in the S plane?
The real component.
Right, so this is just taking this axis and moving it somewhere depending on the value of sigma, right? Still aligned at some value of sigma. So, if I now do the same steps, I take the magnitude of Z as the magnitude of E to the S delta T, that's just going to be E to the sigma times delta T, because the E to the J omega delta T has a magnitude of 1. So this equation, the magnitude of Z is equal to E to the sigma delta T, becomes, if we look at when sigma is less than 0, when sigma is less than 0, I'm in the left half plane, we have all the points which satisfy the magnitude of Z is equal to sigma delta T, but sigma is less than 0, like minus 1. So E to the minus delta T, where is that going to fall in the unit circle? So I'm going to have a magnitude of less than or greater than 1. E to the minus delta T, whatever delta T is. Delta T is a positive number. So E to the minus delta T is going to have a magnitude less than 1. So the left half plane maps to the inside of the unit circle, and the right half plane maps to the outside of the Earth's surface. So that's the net effect of this transformation where we let S, where we let T be equal to N times delta T. So you'll recall if the CT system is stable, its poles lie in the left half plane. We'll talk more about this later in the semester, but we talked about the fact that if you have a pole in the right half plane, you're going to get an e to the sigma t exponential, which is growing in the system, or signal is going to be unstable. So if the system is if the signal or system is stable, you have the poles in the left half plane, which means those poles for a discrete time signal or system to be stable, those poles have to be in the inside the unit circle. So hence the DT system is stable if its poles are inside the unit circle. The Z transform behaves much like Laplace transform, and we'll see how we can apply it to difference equations, produce frequency and time domain responses, and all the kinds of things we were able to do with the Laplace transform. So this is the formal definition of the Z transform, and we observe that to get the frequency response of this system, we're going to look along the unit circle. We'll evaluate this for magnitude of z is equal to 1. And we'll note that the left half plane of the S plane maps to the inside of the unit circle. So those are the main points from that slide. So we can derive the discrete time Fourier transform by setting r equal to e to the j omega. So we can write x of z, we set z equal to r e to the j omega, and we can write this as the sum from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity of x of n, and then for z we're going to substitute r e to the j omega raised to the minus n power. We can factor the r to the minus n out of this equation and write x of n times r to the minus n and look at that quantity times e to the minus j omega n. Well, this we recognize as nothing more than the discrete time Fourier transform of the signal x of n r to the minus n. So the z transform is like taking the Fourier transform of a signal which is the product of x of n times this r to the minus n. Now, for this summation to converge, the absolute value or the magnitude of this term summed from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity must be less than infinity. That's that's essentially what defines our region of convergence, the areas for which this summation is bounded. But this depends only on the value of r. Just like in the S-plane, the Laplace transform depended, or the region of convergence depended on the real value of sigma. So if the unit circle is in the region of convergence, then the DTFT, or x of e of j omega, exists. So let's see an example of this in terms of a signal a to the n u of n, which we observe as a right-sided signal. So the z transform of a to the n u of n is found by taking the sum from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity of a to the n u of n z to the minus n. And this we can write as the sum from n equals 0 to infinity of a to the n z to the minus n. And this we can factor into a times z to the minus 1 raised to the nth power. So we have a summation from n equals 0 to infinity of some number raised to the nth power. Now, this is a little bit of a problem because this summation may not necessarily converge. We can actually write this in a closed form using a summation formula that we'll use frequently throughout this section of the course. But either way, this thing will not converge under all conditions. For this thing to converge, we need this term, this az to the minus 1, to have a magnitude less than 1. So that the terms in this sum tail off to 0, and then the sum, therefore, will be bounded. So for this z transform to converge, we need the magnitude of az to the minus 1 to be less than 1, which is the same thing as saying that the magnitude of z has to be greater than a. And if that's the case, in regions where z is greater than a, then we can write that x of z is equal to 1 over 1 minus az minus 1. So the ROC is outside the circle of radius a for this signal, which means that here's a circle of radius a, and the ROC for this is this region, shaded region, outside of that circle. And it does include the unit circle, which is where we get our frequency response, because we get our frequency response by taking the z transform and evaluating it along the unit circle. So the fact that the ROC curve includes the unit circle means that the discrete time Fourier transform exists. You'll also note that for this signal, what happens when z is equal to 0 here?
That's indefinite.
1 over z is very large, right?
And it becomes very negative.
1 over something very large becomes something very small. So this goes to 0. So we say that x of z has a 0 at z is equal to 0, because when z is equal to 0 here, x of z goes to 0. And we talked a little bit about poles and zeros, and when we talked about CT systems, we'll talk more about all of this later. But for now, we just note that when z is equal to 0, the value of x of z goes to 0. So we call that a 0. So the point here is that, much like the Laplace transform, we have to worry about the convergence of this transform. And this transform converges for the region in the z-plane where z is greater than a. And since that includes the unit circle, we can then say that the discrete time Fourier transform for this signal exists. Now, and part of the reason we're interested in region of convergence is because it's one of the ways we can look at stability. And stability, as we've talked about this semester, is a very important concept when you're dealing with signals and systems. So let's look at a little more closely at stability. Let's look at the case where A takes on different values for the signal A to the N U of N. So when A is equal to 1, we have 1 times U of N. And the region of convergence for this signal, so this is a plot of what that signal looks like. And the region of convergence for that signal is going to be right along the unit circle. So it's everything outside the unit circle. And in a moment, we'll define this as a marginally stable signal. When A is less than 1, the region of convergence is everything outside this circle of radius 0.9. The signal has an exponential decay shape to it, and the region of convergence is everything outside this this circle of radius 0.9, which includes the unit circle. And obviously this system then is stable because the magnitude of A is less than 1. On the other hand, when A is greater than 1, that means the signal is going to be increasing exponentially. Its region of convergence is going to be everything outside of this circle of radius 1.1. It does not include the unit circle. So this is an unstable signal, this is a stable signal, and this is what we call marginally stable. This is sort of like a similar situation to a sine wave and a cosine wave. It's what we call marginally stable because it's constant amplitude for infinity. But from this analysis, we can conclude that if the ROC is outside the unit circle, the signal is unstable, and if the ROC is inside the unit circle, the signal is stable. And if the ROC is on the unit circle, the signal is marginally stable. So this shows you the relationship between the unit circle and the ROC for a simple case of this A to the NU event. And it also shows you something about the pole locations. This, when A is equal to 0.9, this signal has a pole at Z is equal to 0.9. And that pole lies inside the unit circle, so the system is stable. When A is equal to 1, the pole is on the unit circle, the system is marginally stable. And when A is equal to 1.1, the pole is outside the unit circle and the system is unstable. So from this we can conclude that whenever a signal has a pole outside the unit circle, it's going to be unstable. And if all the poles for the signal are inside the unit circle, it's going to be stable. And that's one way that we will analyze systems. We'll take Z transforms, find the poles and zeros, look at the pole locations, and determine stability based on whether the poles are inside the unit circle. So this is a way to relate the ROC curve to the stability of the system. Now we can take a variant of this case. We can look at the case where A is negative. A is here is minus 1.1, minus 1.0, minus 0.9. So this doesn't really change the envelope of the signal, but it does make the signal alternate in size. So we would have reason to believe that the stability properties of the signal shouldn't change all that much. So when A is equal to minus 0.9, the ROC curve is everything, again, is still everything outside of this circle of radius 0.9. It includes the unit circle, and therefore the system is stable because we see the pole is inside the unit circle. The DTFT exists, which is what we evaluate along the unit circle. And as before, when A is equal to minus 1, we have marginally stable, and when A is equal to minus 1.1, we have an unstable signal. So changing the sign of A doesn't really change things all that much. It just makes the signal's amplitude oscillate between positive and negative. So the pole location then becomes the critical piece in whether the signal is stable. So now let's look at a left-sided signal. Left-sided meaning that the signal is defined only for negative values of time. When time is greater than zero, the signal is zero. So we can write an example of that as minus A to the N U of minus N minus 1. And that's just a way of writing this signal, which is going to be non-zero for time less than zero. So again, we can apply the Z transform, and we can take the sum of this signal times Z to the minus N. We can write that as the sum from N is minus infinity to minus 1, since this is only non-zero from minus 1 up to minus infinity. of a to the minus 1 times z raised to the nth power. And in a similar way, we can actually write this summation using a formula that looks like this. I don't want to dwell on this for the moment, but we can observe that, again, this is only going to converge if the magnitude of a to the minus 1 times z is less than 1. And that means that the magnitude of z must be less than a. So for this left-sided signal, the z transform only exists if the magnitude of z is less than a. Well, that corresponds to the region inside a circle of radius a. So here we have the unit circle. Here we have a value of a. In this case, a is less than 1. The region of convergence is inside the unit circle. And in that case, then, this a minus 1 times z is less than 1. This thing goes to 0. And we have that the transform is just 1 minus 1 over 1 minus a minus 1z. And this can be simplified to 1 over 1 minus a to the minus 1 times z. This can be simplified if we find a common denominator and do the algebra. This can be simplified to 1 over 1 minus az minus 1, which can also be written as z over z minus a. So the z transform is the same, but the region of convergence is the inside of the unit circle, not the inside of this circle of radius a, not the outside. So if the signal is left-sided, the region of convergence is the inside rather than the outside. And that's one of the reasons why you can tell something about the signal just from its region of convergence. So we can again look at these three cases where a is greater than 1, equal to 1, or less than 1. Only now we have this left-sided signal, which in this case means when a is less than 1, the pole is inside the unit circle, but since this is a left-sided signal, the region of convergence is inside of this circle. The region of convergence does not include the unit circle, and hence in this case, the signal is unstable. Because it's a left-sided signal. Boy, people are really tired today, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I was actually tired too, so, you know, just hang in there. I think it's also the weather, and it's probably the fact that this is the week before spring break, so you have lots of exams, and you're hoping that you can just survive to live, to enjoy spring break. You know.
Everything is due and there is zero motivation.
But my stuff was scheduled first.
Right.
But that was all there. I got dibs on Friday.
Doesn't change the fact that
you put that on a t-shirt. Spring break symbol 2009.
I'm actually not a fan of spring break, so this is another tirade that you get on very often. I think wouldn't it be better just not to have spring break and get out a week early?
No.
Because the problem with spring break is the whole semester then kind of becomes clustered around spring break. And either one of two things happen. You get killed the week before spring break, like is apparently happening, or some teachers say, oh, I'll be nice, I'll give you the exam after spring break. Well, you walk in here the day after spring break, you don't even remember what class this is. So then you go through that whole, oh man, it's very disruptive. And of course, today we have a scintillating lecture on region of convergence. But the point here is that when the signal is left-sided, the region of convergence is on the inside of the unit circle. So now the pole does not, the pole, because the pole is on the inside of the unit circle, the system's unstable. When the pole is on the outside of the unit circle, the system is stable. So whether the signal is left-sided or right-sided plays a role in whether the system is stable. But the determining factor really is whether the region of convergence contains the unit circle. Now, most of the semester we're going to deal with right-sided signals, but I just show this example to show you the contrasting point to the left-sided signal. So we need to consider one more case, which is if the signal is a two-sided sequence, meaning it has both a portion for time less than zero and a portion for time greater than zero. So here we have an example of a two-sided signal. If the signal is a two-sided sequence and what essentially happens is that the region of convergence ends up being the intersection of the two regions of convergence. So here we have a right-sided signal, and we said the region of convergence was everything outside of a circle for the case where we had one pole. Here we have a left-sided signal. The region of convergence is inside the that circle for the that corresponds to a pole. So for a two-sided signal, the region of convergence is essentially the intersection of these two, which turns out to be this annular ring, which it has is bounded essentially by the two bounded by this radius and bounded by this radius. So let's, as an example, we have a signal x of n is equal to b to the absolute value of n. That's a signal which looks like this or this, depending on whether b is greater than 1 or less than 1. And we can write that signal as the sum of a right-sided signal b to the n u of n plus b to the minus n u of minus n. And for actually, I think this should be b to the minus n minus 1, because we don't want to have overlap at n equals 0. And so we can apply the two Z transforms that we previously derived for the case where Z was greater than B or the case where Z was less than 1 over B. And that then gives us the net transform is the sum of these two. But the region of convergence now is essentially the region between 1 over b and b, because we have the intersection of these two regions of convergence. And you'll note the 1 over b comes about because here we have a b to the minus n rather than a b to the n. So we don't have b to the n here, we have b to the minus n, which means the magnitude of z must be less than 1 over b. So the overall transform of this two-sided signal is the sum of the transform to the left, for the right side and the left side, and that gives us a region of convergence, which is essentially the region between b and 1 over b. And if that region encloses the unit circle, then the system's going to be stable. So that requires b to be less than 1, so that 1 over b is greater than 1. So this is an example of the region of convergence and stability for a two-sided signal. But the main point through all of this is that you need the unit circle to be included in the region of convergence for the system to be stable. Okay, so having said all that, now let's look at some properties of the Z transform, assuming that the Z transforms exist. So naturally, we would expect linearity to hold. We would expect that A times X1 plus B times X2 would result in A times the transform for X1 plus B times the transform of X2. Now, fortunately, with Z transforms, a lot of these properties are really easy to show because you're dealing just with sums. So we can show this. We have the Z transform of A times X1 plus B times X2. That's just the sum of the quantities AX1 plus BX2 times Z to the minus N. And I can very simply write that now. Since this is just a sum, I can write this as two sums one with respect to the first term, one with respect to the second term, and then I can write that those are just, this should be A times X1 of Z plus B times X2 of Z. So linearity holds as we would expect. The time shift property we can show in a similar manner. If I have X of n minus n0, we would expect that to produce some kind of phase shift, Z to the minus n0 times X of Z. And I can, again, I can show that by just simply taking the Z transform of X minus n0. So I can write that at the sum from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity of X of n minus n0 times Z to the minus n. And I can write that as the sum from m equals minus infinity to plus infinity of x of m, z to the minus m plus n0. What I'm doing here is essentially a change of variables. We're going to let m equals this n minus n0, and then I can write that n is equal to m plus n0. And this sum now can be written as, this term can be written as z to the minus m times z to the minus n0. And z to the minus n0 is just a constant, so I can bring that outside the sum. So I can write z to the minus n0 times the sum from minus infinity to plus infinity of x of m and z to the minus m. And this is just then z to the minus n0 times x of z. Now, what was the analog of this for CT, of this theorem for CT signals? When we had time shift with the Fourier transform, for example,
you get e to the negative at.
You get an e to the minus omega t zero, and when we had the Laplace transform, we got an e to the minus s t zero. Here we get a z to the minus n0, but remember z is really just e to the minus st. So this is the same result really as what we got for Laplace transform. And in fact, soon we will show that to get the frequency response, we're going to set z equal to e to the minus j omega. So if I set e equal to e to the minus j omega, I get e to the minus j omega n0. And we see what we saw before in a continuous time case, which is that the time delay is equivalent to phase delay. So this is a completely analogous result to what we got for the Laplace transform, as we would expect, because the two transforms are essentially the same. The only difference is the Z transform is specifically applied to discrete time signals. Let's look at another property, and what happens when I multiply x of n by n, what I get is minus z times the derivative of the transform x of z with respect to z. So I can write that x of z is equal to minus the sum from minus infinity to plus infinity of x of n, z to the minus n. I can take the derivative of this and write this as minus n. The derivative of this thing is just going to, with respect to z, is just going to be essentially minus 1 times z to the minus n minus 1. So the derivative of this with respect to z can be written this way. And then if I can multiply by z and write minus z times that is just going to be n times the sum x of n. When I multiply this by z, I can just get rid of the z minus 1. And I have z to the minus n there, and therefore this can be compactly written as the z transform of n times x of n. And so this is, again, a property. We saw the same kind of thing with Laplace transform. Multiplication by t in the time domain was equivalent to differentiation by s in the Laplace domain. Now, let's think about the consequence of this time domain, time delay theorem. So we have x of n minus 1. What is the equivalent of that in the free, in the z domain?
Z to the negative 1.
Yes, very good. Z.
I guess x of z.
Right, z to the negative 1 times x of z. So if I have a system and I want to take the z-transform of this, this is what we call, we introduced as a linear constant coefficient difference equation. What is the z-transform of that equation going to look like?
Wouldn't it just be z to the negative 1? Oh wait, never mind.
So y of z?
What do you do with the a constant and b constant?
Well, those are constants, right?
Right.
And we can use the property of linearity.
I thought you, wouldn't you have to use the differential?
No, these are con- this is a constant.
Okay.
So this is times a times the z transform of y of n minus 1 plus b times the z transform of x of n. So this is just a times
z to the negative 1.
Negative 1.
X of
y. Y of z.
So y of z.
Plus b times x of z. So, if you're, when we were, so this is the, this is for discrete time. For CT systems, we had, if we had something like dy of t dt, is equal to a times y of t plus b times x of t. How do we map this with the Laplace transform, assuming zero initial conditions? That's a stupid. Well, actually, let me rewrite this. The other. So we have y of s is equal to a times what?
It's not 1 over s squared.
But you don't have to remember it. You can construct it from this. What was the equivalent of this with Laplace domain, with Laplace transform?
I don't see that that's the degree. E to the negative t0 st, or no, negative st0.
And what was the equivalent of this? Does anybody remember this? What's the impedance of an inductor?
J omega L.
In terms of Laplace?
S
times L. And why is it S times L?
Because it's a differentiator.
Because what?
It's a differentiator.
So we have the impedance is S times L. What's the relationship between voltage and current for an inductor?
L di dt.
L di dt, right. Right? That's where the impedance for an inductor comes from. So, differentiation is equivalent to multiplication by S, right? So in this case, we get A times S times y of s plus b times x of s. So for difference equations, all we're going to be doing is multiplying by z minus 1, or z if it's a positive delayed. And it's completely analogous to what we had with Laplace transforms. And in fact, these two equations are very similar from a systems point of view. They're both first order differential equations. So we're going to make use of this property in the discrete time domain, and we've made use of that in the continuous time domain. So what we've done today is to just introduce the Z transform. Easy to compute, just take x of n and sum it, and we'll work a few more examples next class, but it's literally just a matter of summing z's if x of n is finite. So, and we'll go through a few examples of that. We'll talk about a unit pulse next time. We introduced the region of convergence for this transform, much like we talked about region of convergence for the Laplace transform, and we derived the relationship of the region of convergence to the discrete time Fourier transform and stability in terms of the region of convergence has to include the unit circle for the discrete time Fourier transform to exist and for the system to be stable. We then derived three important properties for the Z transform: linearity, time shift, and multiplication. And in your textbook in table 7.1, you have a set of tables for all the other properties, but the main ones we're going to use with the Z transform are these two. And we just demonstrated a little bit of that here, showing the difference equation. So the good news is the Z transform is actually a lot easier to deal with than the Laplace transform, because there's just these summations involved. And all you'll ever be looking at with the Z transforms really are Z transforms of these kinds of difference equations. The other interesting thing about all this, we keep talking throughout the semester about how useful this analysis, this math, is to other areas of science. Well, if you start taking some computer science courses where you talk about iterative algorithms and things like that, we actually analyze those in terms of the Z transform. So you'll see the Z transform used in any time you're trying to analyze properties of, like, iterative solutions to differential equations and things like that. You'll also see the Z transform used a lot in controls in discrete time control systems as well. And we do those in electrical engineering as well as mechanical and other areas like that. Okay, so I think we'll call that a class, and I will see you on Wednesday. Hopefully you'll
be alive.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'll be like half dead instead of totally dead, or maybe...